This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. During last Sunday's pre-inaugural concert at the Lincoln Memorial, one of the most stirring performances was given by one of the day's least well-known performers.
I was born by a river in a little bitty home tent, long just like that river. I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long, a long time coming, but I always believed that a change was gonna come.
That's Betty LaVette singing the Sam Cooke song, A Change Is Gonna Come, which he wrote 45 years ago, a year before his death in 1964. A Change Is Gonna Come became an anthem of the civil rights movement and captured the emotions many Americans felt this week as the country's first African-American president was inaugurated. Yesterday, by the way, would have been Sam Cooke's 78th birthday. But if you've never heard of Betty LaVette and are wondering why, there's a story behind that. After a promising start in the early 60s, when she had a couple of singles that became R&B hits, things just didn't work out for her. The 1972 album she recorded for Atlantic that was supposed to be her breakthrough wasn't released until 2000, when a French producer licensed it from Atlantic and started her comeback. Joe Henry produced an album by her in 2005. Her most recent recording is The Scene of the Crime. Like her 1972 disc, it was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Terry spoke with Betty LaVette last year. Let's start with a song from The Scene of the Crime. Written by Willie Nelson, it's called Somebody Pick Up My Pieces.
I wanna be taken out of contention. I surrender my crown. Somebody pick up my pieces. I think I'm coming down. Well, I sure thought I had it, but Lord, it looks like it had me. 'Cause the thing I thought was heaven was just falling debris. Be crazy, but I sure got a hell of a start. Somebody come here and pick up my pieces. I think I'm falling apart. Now don't follow my feet.
Betty LaVette, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, what kind of places were you singing before starting your comeback in 2005?
Well, it wasn't a lot of places. I was in Detroit, and I was working in little bitty places for $50 a night, and people were drunk or busy talking or dancing or whatever, and I was just around. But I wasn't doing any traveling much at all, just maybe, you know, the faithfuls in Europe who kept having me back there, trying to keep me alive, just from a love affair that started with me in 1965 over there. But I wasn't really working a lot at all. It was more people paying house notes and car notes and whatever for me than me being able to do anything.
So people were helping you with your own bills?
Oh, absolutely.
Were you angry at your lack of recognition?
Oh, for sure. It's not so much anger, but hurt, because it's, you know, it's just being completely ignored. It's not like selling Fuller brushes or something. It's you're selling. So when they don't buy it, they're saying, we don't like you. So it's not my product. We don't like you. So it was very hurtful, very, very painful, if it wasn't for the people who were propping me up.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned before, you grew up in Detroit. When did you start singing?
My parents sold corn liquor from the time they came from Louisiana to Muskegon, Michigan, where I was born, until about maybe 1958. And there was always a jukebox in our living room as opposed to a couch and stuff there are in most people's living rooms. And so I was privy to a whole gang of songs. So I sung as soon as I could talk. My mother said, I've always talked and sung like an adult. She said she used to talk baby talk to me to try to make me sound like a baby. But I pretty much always sounded like James Brown.
That's really funny. So what were the parties like when your parents sold the corn liquor and had the
Well, they weren't really parties. I mean, you know, there was no gambling or prostitution or any of that. People just come and dance and drink for a while. My mother, you know, Louisiana is strictly alcohol and food. So my mother always had the food going. My father had the corn liquor going. And they would stand me sometimes on top of the jukebox, and I could sing along with the songs, blues songs.
Were they songs with meanings that you couldn't quite comprehend yet?
Oh, I didn't know anything about them at all. I mean, I was 18 months old when I first started singing. I first started talking about that point. But there were people, because it was segregation still. So if you came to a little town like Muskegon and you were black, you couldn't drop by a restaurant or a bar anytime you wanted to. So they came to my house. So I had the Five Blind Boys and the Pilgrim Travelers and the Soul Stirrers and all those people at my house.
Wow. So what were, you mentioned some of the musicians who used to come to your house to eat and drink. What was some of the other music you were exposed to early on?
Well, it was, you know, the gospel music, because they would, when they would get drunk, they would sing there at the house, the groups that came. But I don't remember, because it was more of a, it was more conservative. There weren't a lot of people who sung secular music, who sung blues music or whatever that came to my house, because there was this always this drunk prayer type thing going. So we didn't have, like, you know, there were no Sarah Vaughans or those kind of people. But of course, they were on the jukebox and we listened to them. But the people who actually came to the house were chiefly gospel singers.
Now, I'd like to go back to 1962. I believe this is the year you started recording.
Mm-hmm.
And you had, I believe it was your first record that became a hit on the R&B chart. My Man, He's a Loving Man. That was like your first 45, right?
Right.
Okay. So how did you were, what, 17 when you made this?
16.
How did you get to record so young?
It was in Detroit. That wasn't a difficult thing to do. Maybe getting on the Atlantic record label right away was something phenomenal. But in Detroit, every third person either sung, produced, or wrote, or had a record company. So it wasn't difficult at all in Detroit in 1962 to record. All you had to do was show up.
Who asked you to do it?
A young man whose name was Timmy Shaw, who was a local artist, a regional artist, more or less. None of his records had ever been really big. And it wasn't a thing where he wanted me to sing. He was trying to cajole me into something else, but he said, I can make you a star, you know.
Oh.
So he introduced me to his manager and producer, Johnny Mae Matthews, who was one of the first female producers probably in the world, and certainly the only black one. And she was producing him and everybody. She had everybody that Berry Gordy had at one time, but she was just such a crooked woman, she lost them all.
So you got the R&B hit. Did he get you? The guy who was using this as
an excuse? I became a national artist, so that took me out of town.
Oh, right. Okay, so you escaped his clutches.
Yes.
So let's hear it. This is like your first hit, an R&B hit from 1962, and this is Betty LeVette. That's My Man, He's a Loving Man, Betty LeVette, recorded in 1962. Betty, it sounds so low-tech. Describe what the recording session was like.
Well, it took about an hour. It cost about $100, maybe $100, maybe $20. And that was mostly in drinks for the musicians. The guitar player, I can't even think of LeRoy's last name right now, but he was only about, he was younger than me. And they actually snuck him out of his bedroom window to come to the recording session.
That's great.
I mean, it was just the most amazing thing in the world. It was just amazing. I was making a record. It was amazing. And then when they played it on the radio 5 days later, because you could just press it up and walk right into the radio station and say, you play this, and slip somebody $50 or $10 or whatever it was. And so when I heard it on the radio 5 days later, I just ran down the street screaming. Wow. I mean, nobody else in my eighth grade class had a record.
Eighth grade.
Well, I was about, I should have been about in the ninth grade, I guess, ninth or tenth grade.
So,
but it wasn't. I was recording.
What changed in your life immediately after the record started getting airplay?
Nobody in my family had ever been anywhere, or done anything, or had anything. No one had ever had any education, any money, had never traveled, nothing. And all those people who were on that red and black label that I had seen so many years on the jukebox in my house and that I had danced so much after school to, I was on the road with them in like a matter of days.
Like who?
Clyde McFadder, Benny King.
The Drifters?
It was later before I worked with the Drifters. But Otis Redding. We were all, you know, because you tended to, companies tended to send a whole group of their artists around then. So all those people were on either Atlantic or one of their subsidiaries. And I guess Otis Redding and I were the brokest people there. He had the same little shoes and suit every night. And I had my two little gowns that I had. But everybody else, you know, I mean, Benny King had gotten big with the Drifters. Clyde McFadder had gotten big with the Drifters. Clarence Frogman Henry, who it was his very first big record, but it was bigger than mine and Otis's. And Barbara Lynn, it was her first big record, but she had been singing for a while. But I think the brokest people probably were me and Otis. And so that caused us to spend a lot of time together because we weren't the big stars.
What was he like? What was it like to know him?
He was the most wonderful person in the world. And when people say that, they're talking about the Otis Redding they know now. I don't know what he would be like now, or I don't know what he would be like as a legend. But then he was just a broke guy from Georgia who I didn't find very sophisticated and who loved me very much. But I was from Detroit, and blacks at the time felt that if they were born and raised in the North, were a little bit better than blacks who were born and raised in the South. So he just chased me around a lot, and I really kind of thought of him as just maybe one of the other guys who liked me. Had I known he was going to be Otis Redding, I probably would have acted a little better.
What'd you think of his singing then?
Oh, I just thought he was one of the greatest singers I've ever heard in my life, and still do. All the things that I thought about him that I thought wouldn't make him a great suitor, when he was on that stage, he looked different. He was just a totally different person on the stage.
In 1972, you recorded an album that was never released until 2005. Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of famous album now.
And it's more infamous.
And more infamous, thank you, yeah. It was supposed to be released by Atlantic Records. It was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, but it was never released. It just lay in the Atlantic vault until a French producer licensed it from Atlantic and released it in 2000. It was initially supposed to be called Child of the 70s. What were you expecting the outcome of this album to be?
Oh, I really thought I had everything, all the components that I thought would work. I had recorded it in Muscle Shoals, where all the hits were coming from. I had Wilson Pickett's producer, Brad Shapiro. It was on an Atlantic label. It had everything that was supposed to happen. And then it didn't. So all the thoughts right after that were suicidal.
What did they tell you when they didn't release it?
They said, send the tickets back. We've decided not to go forward with the project. Those were their exact words.
But
I don't even know who it was that called me.
But you'd already finished recording it, hadn't you?
It was, I had the plane tickets to go on the road to promote it.
Oh, I see. I see.
They had already done everything.
Oh, wow. I was thinking we could hear Your Turn to Cry. You want to say anything about the song or why it was chosen?
Oh, I just chose it here again because I liked it. But it was, I thought that it sounded, up to that date better than anything I had ever recorded. And I was just completely confused as to why. I said, I kept comparing it to everything else that was out. And everything was just beginning to go stereo, too. So when all the new stereo albums started coming out, then it really didn't sound very good to me. And I kept trying to see myself why they wouldn't do it. And then over the years, I completely convinced myself that it wasn't good.
You were convinced that it wasn't good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's disprove that and play Your Turn to Cry. And this is from the 1972 Atlantic album that was never released until it was licensed by a French producer in 2000. And the French release is called Souvenirs. The subsequent American release of the album is called Child of the 70s.
I gave you all of my love, but you treated me like a fool. I even gave up a right for wrong, trying to get along with you. When I wanted to hold you close, you were always too tired, or you had some place to go.
That's Betty LeVette, recorded in 1972, and the album that this song was recorded for has been subsequently released just a few years ago under the name Child of the 70s.
See, you and your audience are going to be as confused as I am.
Well, all of this happened
30 and 40 years ago, so to just remember it all is just daunting.
Well, the other funny thing is that now you're being praised for the stuff that nobody wanted to even release.
Yeah.
You know, 35 years ago.
Yep.
That must be kind of confusing.
Well, it's, you know, to have all of this energy happening to you at 61 years old is, it's consuming. You know, it's taking virtually everything, every bit of energy that I have and everything that I've ever learned. But I'm glad that I have a lot of energy left and that I learned so doggone much, because it's all coming in handy now.
Well, your new CD is called The Scene of the Crime. And the crime that you're referring to in The Scene of the Crime is the fact that after recording this album, it was never released. It just sat in the Atlantic vault until 2000.
They didn't even know they had it.
They didn't even know they had it.
Uh-huh. They thought that it had been lost in a fire. Uh-huh. And Gilles Pétard came to New York and asked them, could he search for it physically? And he did.
He's the French producer who actually released it in 2000.
Yes, yes, who has been friends with me for almost 30 years. The first 15 or 20 years that we knew each other was strictly through correspondence. It was a long time before I met him. He got me a gig in Paris, and I finally got a chance to meet him.
So he actually had to physically search through the archives of Atlantic to find it?
I had a reel-to-reel copy of it. A friend at a studio here in New York stereorized my mono reel-to-reel version of it, and I let Gilles Pétard hear it. He said, I've got to find this. It's got to come out. It's just got to come out. And he did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to, you know, congratulate you on the success that you're having now.
And, oh, thank you, baby.
Yeah, a long time coming, very well deserved. And
absolutely.
Thank you again, Betty LeVette, for being with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
Singer Betty LeVette speaking with Terry Gross in 2007. Her most recent CD is called The Scene of the Crime. She gave a memorable performance at last Sunday's pre-inaugural concert at the Lincoln Memorial. HBO will be rebroadcasting that concert this weekend.